Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to a new and improved Wittertainment podcast. Isn't that right, Mark?
It is both new and improved, and this week it features our favourites, Jason Isaacs and Julian Temple.
And it's been dimensionalised for your listening pleasure.
It's been retrofitted to come to you live from the Shetland Film Festival.
Describe the scene there live in Lerwick, Mark.
Well, the scene live in Lerwick at the moment is very exciting since Julian Temple has just walked in, which means we now have the full complement of guests, because about 5 minutes ago we didn't have either of them. We had both Jason Isaacs and Julian Temple who had both gone missing.
Well, it wouldn't
Shetland.
Matter, would it? We'd still fill 2 hours.
Yeah, we could fill it. So the way it works is this. About 5 years ago, I was asked to come and introduce a film here at the Book Festival. And I came up and I really liked the place, but was particularly intrigued by the fact that in Shetland there are no cinemas. There's no cinemas here at all. And they said, well, we want to do a film festival, which seemed to me like an interesting idea to do in a place that didn't have any cinemas at all. So for the last 4 years, Linda and I have curated...
She being your other half.
She being, well, the person who does all the work, while I am the person who just wallows in all the glory. Yes, but let me open up Jason's microphone so that he can interject.
Better half, is all I said.
Thank you.
All right, Jason.
Hello, matey.
And Julian's here as well. Say hello to Julian.
All right, Julian.
Hello. I limped in rather than walked in, actually, to tell the truth.
Oh, you will explain to everybody why. This will give you a flavour of Shetland. Julian, why are you limping?
I was forced by Mark to swim in both sides of a kind of spit of sand. There's sea either side. And as you probably can imagine, it's the coldest sea in Britain, I would have thought. And being the wreck of a human being that I am, I ran in there and got, I don't know, something terrible happened to my calf muscle, which was seized up.
It froze solid, probably.
It was worth every second of pain, though.
Why did you do it? Just because Kermode told you to?
He's a leader of men. You can't say no.
You can't look like a wimp, can you, with Mark around?
It was to do with... Because basically there's an awful lot of sea around here, and there's one particularly beautiful bit of beach up at St Ninian's Island, which you get that beach like you get in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It's a bit of beach with sea on both sides of it. And the rule is that you can't say you've been to Shetland unless you've gone to this bit of beach, have run into the sea on one side and put your head under, and then have run across the beach and run into the sea on the other side and put your head under. And I said, this is something you have to do. And of course, both Julian and Jason, both of whom are involved in the movie business, therefore stripped to the waist, looking incredibly tanned and, you know, like people who've been in jet-setting lives. I, on the other hand, look like the fat bloke from Barnet. But I was in and out of the water first, I believe, was the... Correct wave.
He made us drag our children in. Even now I have a child in intensive care. But still, no one wants to know what we did in our summer holidays, do they?
So the movies that are being shown there, now I'm just guessing that there may well be a few Julian Temple movies and the odd movie starring Jason Isaacs.
Well, should we start with... Let's start with the Julian Temple stuff. As you know, I was a huge fan of All City Confidential, and one of the things I said...
I was listening to the soundtrack this morning, actually, while working.
Isn't it a cracking soundtrack?
What a great CD that is.
Except I do think that the inclusion of Shaking All Over by Johnny Kidd and the Pirates in the middle of all the Dr. Feelgood stuff is strange, and I always skip over that. Anyway, so I said it's great... But it needs to be seen in the cinema. I know that it was, you know, a lot of people have seen it on television, but it needs to be seen in the cinema. And so one of the things that we wanted to do, because one of the themes of the festival this year is music and movies, was to get Julian to come up here and to introduce that. And then Julian said, well, actually, I just made this other documentary, which he wanted to bring up as well. So we looked at that as well and thought, fine. So we are showing... Well, Julian, tell us about Requiem.
The other film is a film that was shown on BBC Two earlier this year called Requiem for Detroit, which, although is kind of fueled by the music, it's not really about the music. It's more about the extraordinary arc of that city that, you know, used to be the fourth biggest city in America, built the American dream as well as the cars that people drove, and is now, basically in danger of being erased from the map. It's an extraordinary sense you get there when you drive in from what is a relatively normal airport through suburbs that seem like America, and then suddenly you seem to fall through a black hole into a time that could be 1,000 years in the future, the kind of ruins of a once great civilization that you realize is your civilization. It's a very odd feeling, and I hope the film captures that. But exciting to make a film about something that profound and shocking, really.
So we're getting both of those shown on the, what we have as the big screen at the moment, which is the Garrison Theatre. It's a theatre in which they drop a screen down behind and we project them. Next year, there is actually for the first time going to be a cinema in Shetland, which they're finishing building now. So next year's festival actually will be in a cinema. But at the moment, we're in the Garrison Theatre, which is lovely.
Are they calling it the Commode Cinema?
I've tried, you know, I've talked to them, Jason. They're just not listening. And then Jason is here with some Harry Potter movie. And
The new one, the double bill.
People will be swimming here, Simon. Don't say that.
Pirate copy. We've got a pirate copy up here. Anyone wants
it? I filmed it on my phone. No, we've got Chamber of Secrets and Skeletons.
Skeletons.
It's lovely. And some quite interesting television work. They've got Scars and Curse of Steptoe, which will just hopefully elicit the discussion about what is your responsibility when you take people's real lives and put them on the screen, and what's the purpose of it, and how much should you be allowed to cheat to tell a good story.
Edwina Miller, who lives in Toowoomba in Queensland, Australia.
Yeah.
You returned in the nick of time. I could feel the withdrawal symptoms starting to kick in with a vengeance. I almost took matters into my own hands, but resisted the temptation to smother my hair in pomade, put on some Elvis Costello glasses and yell at someone about Sex and the City too. Hello to Jason Isaacs is the perfect guest to return with. Who else but the sexiest man in the UK could bring the required gravitas to the microphone? Star of stage, screen and Snittlegrass, Mr. Isaacs has been the go-to guy for tastefully smouldering Englishmen for years. Keep up the good work, sir.
That's from my mother again, is it?
Edwina Miller in Australia.
God love her.
Can I just say something on the subject of Jason as whatever he is, sexiest man in blah, blah, blah.
This morning,
I couldn't get an internet connection because we're in these two buildings that are next door to each other, and Jason is in the building that has got the internet terminal, and I haven't. And I had to go and knock on the door, say, I'm terribly sorry, I need to get on my email so that I can do something. And Jason opened the door to me this morning in a state of bedragglement at about 8:30, and looking like, for all the world, like the sort of the buffed up movie star that he. I thought, that is it a rule that if you're in movies, you have to have the pecs and the thing?
Right, here's the truth. I saw Mark coming. I did 100 press ups, painted my body with Cuprinol, and put some false eyelashes on. Mm-hmm. Now it's all out on the table.
But you are in a kickboxing movie. That's what I am.
It is true. I have a body that doesn't quite look like my normal body because I did a film with Taylor Lautner recently, and I lived in mortal dread of the director suggesting I take my T-shirt off. So I did quite a lot of gym action and quite a lot of not eating my favourite foods for a while. But since I've arrived in Shetland, it's been 2 days of nothing but Twix.
There's a diet for a man. Declan on this email. Dear BJ and the Bear, glad you're back from holiday. I have a question for Julian Temple. Is it true that you directed the brilliantly high camp Judas Priest videos from the early 80s, including Breaking the Law and the even greater Hot Rockin'?
Totally guilty of that, yeah. I saw them as a comedy band. I didn't realise they were supposed to be something else.
Did you tell them?
No. I asked them to, you know, like, set their boots on fire and, you know, they seemed very quiescent, actually. But they were at a time when, you know, I'd worked with the Sex Pistols. There was a great terror of the Sex Pistols. Yeah. Judas Priest, I don't think had heard of the Sex Pistols, so it didn't seem to matter.
Now, what we do need to mention is, because Mark has been away like forever, it means that when we go through the box office top 10 just after 3, there will be large gaps.
And huge gaps.
There will continue to be large gaps as we go through the next few weeks. So what we would like, please, via email probably, because the text will be too long, but, you know, if you want to spend all the money on a long text, that's fine. In the box office top 10, the stuff you haven't seen, Mark, would include...
Well, basically, because I've been away. So Marmaduke I haven't seen. Avatar I've seen, but obviously not the longer version.
Right, so if you've been to see the longer version, how many extra minutes is it? 8?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't seen it, Simon. Have you seen it? Well,
I hope it's another 8 minutes of people singing in front of that tree.
Yes.
Okay, so if you have seen the new version of Avatar with the extra singing, ringing tree sequence... we want an email on that. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, I think,
yeah,
we need stuff on
that. That. Inception, of course, we have thoroughly
Don't
covered.
Need Inception. Piranha, we do. We yes. want some Piranha stuff. Salt, I can do that.
You're doing Salt.
Yeah, The Expendables, we need one on that.
One
we don't
that.
Need Toy Story 3.
Although I have, incidentally, I've now been back to see it in 2D.
Okay.
And so we
still don't need it.
No,
we
no,
don't
no,
need
no,
it
no,
twice.
No, don't need it twice.
Scott Pilgrim?
Well, you see, I was planning to see Scott Pilgrim this week, but there are no cinemas in Shetland. So I'm afraid that after the great Floyd Boyd showdown last week, in which they were, I don't know whether you listened to this, but they were really completely...
If I'm on holiday, I tend not to, but anyway, yeah.
No, but they were completely... Well, it is possible to listen to the radio whilst on holiday, Simon. I'm sure many people...
Only if you're paranoid about the people who take over.
Or if you're interested in the new releases and want to know what Floyd and Boyd have to say about them, which I found very interesting.
Rubbish,
what was interesting was that... I am paranoid as well. Was that they were completely split. Was that... Boyd thought that it was really great and really entertaining and terrific and fabulous, and Floyd thought it was nerdly and, you know, geeky.
All right,
in
so,
the extreme.
Okay, so something on Scott Pilgrim and Grown Ups as well. We need something on that.
So all of those.
I've seen that.
Jason, you've seen
I just worked with Maria Bella. Who's
yeah, but you won't say anything interesting because you all work
That's
with these
correct.
People.
So. That's correct.
So your review will just be how great it is. Yes?
I'll tell you off air.
Okay. Do a review in mime.
Okay, so anyway, mail@bbc.co.uk on the email if you can help us out with that for the box office top 10. So coming up next, we'll do more with Jason and more with Julian Temple and more about the Shetland Film Festival. Just some correspondence here from Dr. Sandy Nelson in Derry. We note to say how ridiculously thrilled I was to very briefly meet Dr. K over the summer. I was sitting at work, a quiet Sunday shift in A&E, writing up my notes when a bespeckled and bequiffed face appeared at the desk. I exclaimed, "Nice to meet you, Doctor," and a nonplussed Mark kindly shook my hand and exchanged banal small talk, whilst obviously just wanting to get his wife's foot fixed. The rest of the staff in A&E thought he was an old doctor colleague of mine from Glasgow. Here's the killer bit. I then couldn't resist saying hello to Jason Isaacs over the tannoy system, much to my own amusement. I hope you enjoyed the rest of your time in Northern Ireland. So there you go. So there was Dr. Sandy Nelson, so thrilled to meet you that her first instinct was to go to the tannoy and say hello,
hello to Jason Isaacs.
And
I have to say that not only is that entirely true, that did cheer my broken-footed other half up enormously to hear them saying hello to Jason Isaacs over the tannoy, even as her foot was being fractured. So, and I'm sorry if it was a banal small talk. I thought it was witty. And anybody, but you know, it was A&E. What were you going to do?
Well, I think I'd like to have been there in that hospital as the tannoy, you know, which normally is carrying urgent messages about, you know, will doctor so and so and consultant so and so report to reception because there's something bad going on. Suddenly, someone just saying hello to Jason Isaacs.
One of the things I was trying to figure out how to do up here, because Shetland is a collection of tiny, there's lots of interconnected islands. I was trying to figure out a way to get somebody on every one of the islands to say hello to Jason Isaacs at the same time. But I haven't figured out the logistics of how you'd actually make it work.
Sounds like a thrilling idea, though, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does.
So I'll tell you a tannoy story. I went to see the Cirque du Soleil show in Vegas years ago, and I was flown out there by the Patriot to do some publicity for something. And the manager, you know, he gave us the house seats because we were there with Sony, and he came up afterwards. He said, "Would you like to meet the cast?" And I said, "No, that's all right. They've all just been working unbelievably hard, and I'm sure they need a rest." She said, "No, they love to meet celebrities." I said, "I'm not a celebrity. That's very kind of you, but I, you know, I'm here promoting a film with Mel Gibson, and if he was here, I'm sure that no, they'd love to meet you." So Emma said, my wife said, "We better go. We've got free tickets." So we go backstage, and as we walk through, we can hear on the tannoy they're going, "Please gather in rehearsal room A. We have a British actor, Jacob Isaacs. He's the guy from The Patriot. I know you don't want to go, but if you go, it encourages people. Like, he's in a movie with Mel Gibson. Maybe you could tell Mel, maybe next time Mel comes. So please turn up to rehearsal room A." That's the level I live
That's
at.
Going to undermine you just a little bit. Yeah, but great
just a
accent,
bit.
Jason.
That,
again,
so
further proof that you're the king of that accent. Ben from Bushy, way before the wigs of Potter and moustaches of the Green Zone, and in a time when probably no one used to say hello to him, Jason appeared in one of my all-time favourite BBC dramas. And since HBO came about, probably the last one I watched, Civvies. Yeah. I remember being totally caught up in it and becoming incredibly emotional at the end as the wonderful Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits played out. Could he ask Jason of his memories and, more importantly, anything on DVD from Civvies?
But you know, Civvies was very interesting because at the time it came about because Linda LaPlante knew a bunch of guys who were back from the Falklands, from the parachute regiment, and there was no transition really. They left, they were killing people one day, they left the army, and then they were kind of dumped in civilian life, unable to cope. And they all ended up, as I think I remember rightly, that most of them ended up in prison. And she wrote this series, and she wanted to raise the issue of how many ex-service people ended up either on the streets or drug addicted or in prison. And there was such an outcry about it, I don't think you'll ever see it repeated or on DVD. But at the time, the newspapers were... You know, it was a terrible controversy, and she was much maligned by serving people. Now, of course, it's acknowledged as a real issue, and now there is some mechanism for help people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, thank God. So it was interesting. It was before its time.
Now an entertaining line of questioning from Mark.
Well, in terms of the stuff that we're showing...
Sorry, was that too serious afternoon?
No, not at all. No, I just thought it was time for Mark to do some work.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Simon, because obviously I don't ever do enough work. In terms of the stuff that we're showing at the festival, because Skeletons and Scars. Skeletons, you've pretty much done the length and breadth of the country flying the flag for Skeletons, which you're enormously proud of.
I just think that it's very hard to make films in Britain anyway. It's very hard to make them, get them seen. To make a film like Nick Whitfield did that is so unique and idiosyncratic and not trying to be some other genre of film. He seems to me like a new voice and uniquely British. It wins a very prestigious prize at the Edinburgh Film Festival against much noisier, more expensive films, but there's not that many places showing it. So wherever it is showing, I'd like to get out there and, you know, and bang the drum for it. I'm thrilled that you asked for it to come up here. I think he's very, very talented, and I think, you know, like most of my contemporaries, I look over the ocean and I look to America often for work and decent work, because that's where things are getting made and shown. And when there are strong voices at home, we should champion them.
And in terms of the kind of material that you get offered in Britain, we were talking earlier about a film that I won't name and I won't mention the director, but you said that there was something that came to you and you read it and you said, actually, I don't actually want to be part of that. And one of the feelings is that work is so scarce that anything one gets offered, one has to consider...
Oh, that's true, but then a lot of things in Britain, you know, hopefully that... even though they've got done away with the Film Council, that the government will continue to support film in some way with tax breaks. But a lot of films in Britain get made at a micro budget and then don't get seen. I don't work for money, really. Every now and again I have to work for money, obviously. But that's not the first thing that draws me into things. But it is heartbreaking to make films or stay on films for a long time, to have them collapse in pre-production or in production or be made and never distributed. There are some very talented people making fabulous things in England, but it can, after a while, it can get to you when... you end up with a DVD to show for it and not much else.
And what about in the case of Curse of Steptoe? Because the big issue with Curse of Steptoe is you're telling a true story about, you know, a life that was really lived, and therefore how much is it able to be inventive, and how much do you have to stick to? I mean there must be people around.
It's tough. It's a very... I think it's a really interesting area, because we all like to watch biopics and we see them on the big screen, we see them on the little screen, and Paul Greengrass being the man who's kind of making Bloody Sunday and making 1993, who has in many ways started a new way for people doing these things rather brilliantly and authentically. But there are always editing decisions, there's always characters amalgamated. You can't put an entire life on the screen. So with The Curse of Steptoe, which was, you know, won all kinds of prestigious prizes and everybody got nominated for things, and yet there were surviving relatives who complained to the BBC that it wasn't entirely accurate in some aspects.
Oh, so there were complaints?
Oh yeah, and it's very difficult to be completely accurate about a person's life. My wife researched a film about Robert Maxwell at one point that the BBC were going to make. And in the end, although all of the things that he did, all of the criminal things that he did, were so well documented, and that he went into a meeting with some particularly powerful billionaire and the result was this action, was well documented, the film wasn't made because the dialogue that they had, that they'd written for them to say in the scenes, wouldn't get past defamation, you know, a defamation action. So it's very, very difficult. And I remember seeing... In the Name of the Father,
yeah.
Watching the director on a panel with Paul Greengrass. Jim Sheridan's name I've forgotten briefly, I'm sorry. Saying, I don't care that they weren't in the same cell, and I don't care that Gareth Pearce was the solicitor and he had a different barrister. The point is, the story is true. And the Daily Mail were always going to bash me for telling the story. I mean, these decisions are things you have to make. They're a question of tone and discretion always, and are you giving fuel to your enemies by changing certain things? It's interesting. I'm interested that we're showing that and see what the audience think, because I know what I think as the storyteller, but sometimes audiences, you know, take offence at it, and sometimes they don't care if you're true at all. Robin Hood, for instance, I'm not sure quite how accurate that was.
Well, I believe Robin Hood actually was an Australian Irishman. I think he was.
I think they uncovered some old archive material,
yeah.
And that was just like Mel Gibson claimed, I remember, when he did Passion of Christ. He said, this is a straight transcript of the Gospels. Which I'm not sure is 100% accurate. He did. I heard him in an interview.
This from... it's actually from Jason in Victoria, but he's calling himself Titch for reasons that will become obvious. Dear Dave D. Dozy, Beaky and Mick, yeah. I recently saw Oil City Confidential and Requiem for Detroit, both superb and very moving. That's all. That's what he says. But I just wanted to include Julian in the conversation.
I was waiting to get past the half past news break in order to do that. So do we have to break now for news, or are you just letting that go?
Well, we don't we don't break for the news. We incorporate it as a key feature.
You understand what I mean? Because yes. I was yes.
No, I didn't realise that. Paul in London, dear Dr. K, the reason Shaking All Over is included in Oil City Confidential is because Wilco Johnson based his guitar style on the guitar playing of Mick Green from the Pirates.
Yeah, no, I know why it's
keep
there.
Up.
What I know, what I'm saying is when you're playing the CD in the car, I know why it's there.
It's weird, yeah. The order is weird.
It's just a strange thing to have there. In the same way as having Poison Ivy there makes sense as well. But on the other hand, what you're listening to is a collection of Dr. Feelgood songs at that point.
One of the saddest things I think about the Oil City that actually isn't in the film is that Wilco did listen to Mick Green and thought, you know, God was playing the guitar twice at the same time.
That's right, he thought it sounded like two guitarists.
And, you know, went away and devoted years of his teenage life to try and master this way of playing. And then finally it emerged much later on that there were actually two guitars playing on those early Pirate albums. So Wilco was doing the impossible and achieved it. But needn't have bothered in a way.
On the emails, okay. Looking for a couple of, you know, a paragraph or two on Grown Ups, The Expendables, Piranha 3D, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Avatar with the extra few minutes. If you see, not the old one, because we've all seen the old one, but the one with the extra 8 minutes singing in front of the ringing tree bit. Yep. And Marmaduke as well. It's mayo@bbc.co.uk.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
Mark Kermode in Lowick for the Shetland Island Film Festival, along with Jason Isaacs. And Julian Temple as well, not Jonathan Temple, that would not be appropriate. So I would like to ask you, Jason, just because it's relevant, Jason and Julian, the next project that you're working on will be what? This is relevant to the next piece of correspondence.
Well, just to follow on from where we were about, you know, fictionalising people's lives,
yes.
I'm hoping anyway to do a thing, a film about the Davis brothers, the Kinks in wider parlance, who, as most people know, make the the Gallagher brothers look like the Beverly sisters, really. And so when you make a film of their story, you've got to have two versions of the truth kind of running parallel, because they see everything in such opposing forms. Mm. So there's a kind of, you know, something interesting about the Rashomon idea of two different takes of the same event, you know, however mundane, that becomes totally fascinating. For example, you know, in the classic, you know, Greasy Spoon stop off in the van as they were touring up and down Britain in the mid-60s or whatever. You know, they pull in and have their chips, a plate of chips and so on. And there was an occasion where Dave reached out with his fork because Ray's had arrived earlier than his and was going to just prong a chip. And Dave always, Ray obviously thought he was trying to stab him through the heart, you know, so a huge fight would ensue over what the motive was of this fork reaching out to a plate of chips. And of course, the fascinating, the beginning of heavy metal, without them, no Judas Priest, you know, the distortion of You Really Got Me launched all sorts of hard rock and yes. things. Dave swears blind that he did it with razor blades, slashed the amp to create the distorted sound in the front room of the Kinks flat. Ray insists it was his mother's knitting needles. And if you mention that to Dave, he will, you know, pretty much knock you out for saying it, for suggesting it even. So, you know.
Right, so you take your life in your hands with that next project. Yeah. All right, Jason, what's next for you?
Interesting. I'm coming straight back to Scotland, actually, in a couple of weeks. I'm in Edinburgh filming for the BBC a 6-part version of the Kate Atkinson novels, crime novels, called Case Histories, although in fact it's 3 novels, the first one being called Case Histories, playing Jackson Brodie, her iconic detective.
Does he have facial hair?
Quaking at the boots. Well, I'm quite fancying a beard and moustache, and the producer is not so keen. We'll see how that one plays itself out.
Okay, the reason I ask is we have an email here from Lawrence, who says, I found this little quiz on the internet to help filmmakers avoid making rotten movies. And I was wondering if you could add any more. There are 75 of these. Anyway.
Can I just say, bear in mind, you're having this conversation in the presence of an actor who has worked with Michael Bay.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
So carry on at your peril.
Okay, so I will read these out, and if you feel you want to interject, either of you, at any stage, then that's fine. So this is the exam. Okay, question one. Have you hired a professional wrestler to act in a starring role? Next. Does the name of your movie end in Roman numerals? Is the special effects budget of your movie more than the GNP of a third world nation? Does your movie contain any cute, fuzzy little creatures or any other easily merchandised feature?
Well, Gremlins and E.T. I'm sorry, I can take hold of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Does Kevin Costner have anything to do with your movie?
Oh.
How about Keanu Reeves?
Kevin Costner was in The Big Chill. Fantastic film.
Kevin Costner was in... everyone called Dances with Wolves Kevin's Gate before it opened, and it turned out to be a perfectly decent film.
Have you hired Quentin Tarantino to punch up the dialogue? What else do we have here? Does the title of your movie contain any of the following words? Fatal, passion, forbidden, obsession, or desire? Does the script require any members of the cast to wink at the camera, literally or figuratively, at any time? How do you plead to any of those questions, Jason?
I've been in all of those things. I've been with a professional boxer and a professional wrestler. I've been with furry creatures. I've got an elf called Dobby that stood by my side. And I think I've broken all those rules, actually, and been in some rather decent films.
And Julian, you have directed a movie with a professional boxer. You directed a Mickey Rourke movie. He was a professional boxer before he was an actor.
He wasn't a wrestler, though. He acted that one, didn't he?
That's right.
I think he did.
We just narrowly escaped that.
Okay, fine.
But yes, Mickey Rourke.
They are a decent set of rules. I certainly like the title stuff, the passion, obsession, desire, all that stuff. Titles are incredibly important. A friend of mine, who's a fantastic writer, sometimes I go around to his house and he goes, which one of these should I write? And he runs by me, you know, End of Time, Doing the Right Thing, you know, Sweet Dreams. And I go, what are they about? And he goes, I've no idea. I've just got the titles.
I did do a commercial called Passion, Elizabeth Taylor's perfume, Passion.
You
commercial.
Did a commercial for Elizabeth Taylor's perfume?
I thought I could see your stamp on that.
Yep, and she had this strange board that allowed her to stand up and lie down at the same time.
I want one of those.
She was suffering from incredible back pain at the time, and the one thing I really remember is that she insisted I only the director of this commercial could go and see her in her dressing room. She wouldn't allow anyone, no AD or anyone else. And when I went in, she said, I have to see you. It's about something. It's really important. Come and see me. She ordered five hamburgers and would only have me go out and get the hamburgers for her. And this is when she was full diet, you know, looking as thin as she could for this commercial. So I did run hamburgers for Elizabeth Taylor on a Passion commercial.
God.
That is a good name for a movie, though, isn't it? I ran hamburgers for Elizabeth Taylor.
To be shown at the Shetland Film Festival next year.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
And an email from Piers Thompson aimed specifically at Julian Temple, I think. Seeing as the Portobello Film Festival opened last night, says Piers, is it an appropriate time to re-examine Absolute Beginners, surely one of the most unfairly reviled movies of all time, along with Kevin Allen's Twin Town and my movie, I Want Candy, says Piers. Surely the opening tracking shot is one of the most accomplishments by a British director still working in the movies. Discuss.
Well, we were just talking about this last night.
Just about working. Sorry.
We were just talking about this last night. You said that actually there was a possibility of going back to revisit Absolute Beginners.
Well, bizarrely, we had can you believe this? A sold-out screening of Absolute Beginners at the Goodwood Vintage Festival with myself and Steve Woolley, the producer, there. I think the huge thundercloud that burst open on the festival just as the movie began helped, you know, fill the place up. But it was all we'd wished for when the film came out, actually. It suddenly finally became true. So I reckon your film and my film probably do have things in common. But I think Absolute Beginners, you know, I wore it like an albatross or a film reel around my neck for about 30 years. So I have mixed feelings about it, but I still feel there are good things about it, and as well as bad things. And it didn't look that bad when I saw it the other day. So,
but you talked about the possibility of going back and doing a director's cut, because what you said was that actually the way that the film finally came out probably wasn't the ideal way of it being put together. Perhaps the editing process was rather more fraught than it should have been.
Yeah, well, me and Steve were fired as soon as...
That was what I was avoiding saying, but thank you for saying it.
Production ended, and, three editors were hired. One took the beginning part, and the middle was taken by the second, and the last guy did the end. And they didn't apparently talk to each other, these guys. They were in different cutting rooms all over London. And so at Christmas, we were called saying, over the Christmas period, you can now are allowed back to try and salvage the edit, but you're not allowed to reprint any of the existing takes. So what they'd managed to do, if nothing else, was to cut up that opening shot into seemingly millions of different bits. Frames were missing everywhere. And obviously with missing frames, you can't put the shot together unless you reprint. So we spent most of the 2 weeks trying to put that opening shot back together. Therefore, the rest of the movie perhaps suffered slightly. So,
but it's a good opening shot.
Yeah, the opening shot was worth it all, that opening shot, still.
Question on film festivals, really, for all of you. Clearly, this is an unfair comparison, but on the Cannes Film Festival, it's clearly not for the people of Cannes, is it? It's for the rest of the world to come along and Mark to be grumpy about it. Mm. The Shetland Film Festival, at the other sort of line of the film festivals, is it for the people of Shetland to go and see movies, or is it to attract people to go to Shetland and sort of part of the tourist activity there?
Well, as I said, the way it works here is that it's entirely for the people who are here. Funnily enough, this is the first year we've had people coming to Shetland to attend the festival, rather not guests, but people coming along to, you know, to watch the festival. Because when we started doing it, we did it entirely for people who were here. I mean, actually, they're a bit. It takes quite a long time to get from the furthest reaches of Shetland down to Lerwick. Anyway, if you're coming from Unst or Yell, it's quite a way down. But so it is. It's specifically for the public, and it's a matter of us showing films that we want to show. I mean, like last night, for example, we showed this Mark Cousins documentary. He's made this terrific documentary in which he went to this very, very remote village in Iraq where the kids had never seen movies but have seen, you know, all manner of atrocities. And Mark went out there with a sheet and a projector and a collection of international kids movies, showed these kids some kids movies, including E.T. and including Red Balloon, and then gave them digital cameras and said, film your lives. And he made this really extraordinarily poetic, I mean, very beautiful film. And Julian, you came along, so it was lovely.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It's an incredible insight, amongst other things, to the nature of childhood, which, bizarrely, with all these horrible things of the gassing of villages and so on that they've been through there, childhood seems to exist in a way that it doesn't anymore in the West.
Yeah.
These kids have access to childlike imagination without, you know, 100 television channels giving them what to dream about. They have to create their own connection with the world, and it's really powerfully captured in this film.
And what's really nice about it is, I mean, obviously, you know, it's something which has got television funding, and most people will see it on television, but it's lovely seeing it projected in a room in which you can actually feel people responding to it. So, I mean, yeah, the festival here is entirely for the people to come and see the films, whereas Cannes is a film market. I mean, I have a particularly jaundiced view of Cannes, but I imagine that everybody who works Cannes is the same thing. It is, in the end, a cesspit of intergalactic proportions.
Well, the topless beaches of Shetland are pretty good as well.
Where have you been?
It's cold enough that your nipples would tear holes
in
a chainmail jacket.
I don't know
what you're talking about.
But you must have.
I've been to a lot of film festivals, and the thing that mostly that I like about them, not Cannes but other places, is that whether people are bussed in or not, it's full of people who just love to watch films. And it's not people who go out on Friday night and want to see lots of things explode. They love to watch films, and you know. It can get very, very dull when actors, writers, directors and film critics bang on about to the public, telling them to go and see things that seem to them obscure or, you know, minority taste. But my experience has been when people are in front of a wider variety of films than they normally watch, they love them. The good ones, they love them, they're completely hooked. Even in my own family, if I force people, or I am forced to watch a film with subtitles that I've been reluctant to watch, when they're good, I'm completely transported. And when you're in a big, dark room with a big image, you're even more transported than when only 10% of your vision is taken up with the screen. So I love film festivals. I would encourage anybody who's even vaguely thinking about it to get down to whatever it is, whether it's London Film Festival or Brighton or Shetland or anywhere, and watch some of the things that might not come to your local cinema, because pretty much most of the time you'll have a fantastic time.
But also the merits of this one is that, you know, you're showing one of the older Harry Potter films, and aren't you going to do some question and answers
with
some kids, you know?
Oh, yeah, I'll do Q&As, and I'll do a Q&A on Scars and all this stuff. And I say, I was thinking when we were talking before about putting real stories on screen, the first time I did it was Sibbys, but the second time was with Paul Greengrass. We did a thing called The Fix about a footballer called Tony Kaye, who was at the heart of a tremendous fixing scandal, and he was banned from playing football for life and went to prison. And there was a point
Sounds
at which
like film director.
Yeah, and there was a point at which the guy was, he went to court and he was told he could never play professional football again. And he'd won the FA Cup and the League Cup and all this stuff. And I said to Paul, there should be a scene of him by himself, just heartbroken, before he leaves his big house with his wife. Let's have a scene of him crying in the bathroom. And Paul and I discussed it, and we shot it. And when we did the screening finally of the film, Tony Kaye came with his big orange sunglasses on. He's a very dour Yorkshireman. He doesn't give anything away. And we were very nervous at his reaction. And we went over to him when the lights came up. And we said, well, and he said, how did you know? And Paul said, what do you mean? He said, how do you know? And Paul said, well, you told me, Tony. I did 100 interviews with you. He said, I told you what happened. I never told you how it felt. And that's the reason to put people's stories on screen if you do it right, like Paul Greengrass always does. that, you know, you get a sense of what people are experiencing, not just the stuff that happens to them that's reported in the papers.
It's very funny, that thing of showing people. I mean, even if it's a, you know, not a fictional thing, I remember I did a film with the Rolling Stones on IMAX. And the first thing they said, no, the IMAX guys, no close-ups, you know. So the first thing I did was get that longest lens on Keith Richards' face. And it's like looking at
Mount Rushmore,
landing on Mars, you know, kind of thing. And then we had a screening for them up. We had to fly them all up to Bradford for this screening. So it's taken most of their day. As soon as it started, Ronnie, they ran out of the room screaming. They couldn't believe how old and wrecked they looked on a 100-foot IMAX screen, which I don't blame them for.
There's something else as well. If you've ever been unlucky enough to go for dinner with a comedian, they just get on your nerves. They sit there, they try out material with you, and it's just, it's incredibly dull.
Who was the comedian in your case?
Pretty much any of them in the profession. The very same stuff that's dull at dinner, when you watch it with 500 people, you're crossing your legs trying not to wet yourself. And stuff that will move you en masse with a large group of people in the theatre or in the cinema, it doesn't have the same effect when you watch it at home on DVD, because there's something to do with acknowledging your collective humanity. It sounds pretentious, but it's an emotional thing. And it happens when you're in a big dark room with people. And it's a magical experience.
Well, if I can just chip in on this, the other thing is that, obviously, because the place that we're showing the films here, which is the Garrison Theatre, which is an old theatre built in 1903... And
call that old.
No, no, but I mean, it's, you know, it's like, it's not like your local Odeon. And tonight we're showing a silent film. We're showing this William Hart movie, White Oak, and we're doing musical accompaniment to it, live musical accompaniment to it. And there is something lovely about being in because cinemas used to be theatres. They used to be a performance of a film. It's not a showing of a film. The film would be performed. This is my big bugbear nowadays. You go to a multiplex and it's just one poor guy running from screen to screen, hitting go on the projector, and it's not like the thing is actually a proper performance.
Well, go and see a play then.
Well, Simon, I'd like plays as well, but there's no reason why plays should be taken care of, but a film should just be allowed to, you know, get... There is a terrible thing nowadays, which is that we have forgotten that actually...
Nowadays,
when...
listen to you.
No, but look, we have forgotten that when you play a film, when you run a film through a projector, when you put... It is a performance. That therefore requires the projectionist, a properly qualified projectionist, to be there nursing the film through the projector. And this is something I've become quite annoyed about in the past few years.
I know, I've heard.
Projectionists are a dying breed. Projectionists are being...
I didn't know you felt so strongly, Mark.
I know.
You know, but also just that thing about being...
Do you have an opinion on 3D by any chance?
Let's not even go there. The new Harry Potter movie's in 3D. Anyway.
Listen, Mark, we've got another hour.
Sorry.
Julian and Jason have to go.
Okay.
So why don't you give them the last 30 seconds?
Okay, so of the stuff that you're looking forward to, Julian, what are you looking forward to?
Tijuana, the most dangerous place on earth.
Fantastic. Jason?
Got outro music. I can't believe it. It's like being at the Oscars. Oh, no, I don't want to thank my mum and my children and hello to everyone else. I love this show. I'm so glad you're back. I've missed you terribly.
Hello to Jason. Hello to Julian. Goodbye, Julian. Goodbye, Jason.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Still time for a quick Marmaduke review, I discover. 85058, probably the best way to get in, as it is at number 10. You'll have to be very fast. But if you have spent some of your hard-earned money on Marmaduke, 85058, and then we'll kind of wander through, kind of stagger through the box office top 10 in just a moment. The reviews, however, in this hour will feature which particular films?
I think we'll definitely start off with A Dinner for Schmucks, Last Exorcism, Switch, Certified Copy, Cherry Tree Lane, if we get there, so plenty to come.
Now, a bit of business first of all.
Yeah.
On Radio 2 this week, I had James May on the programme.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about his new book.
James May, the guitarist of Queen. Oh, no, that's Brian May.
That's Brian May. James May being the presenter of Top Gear.
Oh, yes, right.
Yes. Anyway, in particular, we talked about dueling, which is one of the features that he looks at in his new book and indeed TV series. And he was very, very enthusiastic about using it as a way of settling long-standing and very serious disputes.
Mm-hmm. I've got a feeling, you see, Simon, that you are secretly itching for a bit of a scrap with someone.
Well, I could fight Kermode because I have got a bronze award in fencing many years ago.
Ah, you see, you shouldn't admit that.
Okay, well, he won't be listening.
Okay, so it depends which of you challenges the other. If you challenge him, he, as the challenged man, has the right to choose the weapons. And if he doesn't know a fencer, he may feel that it's correct to choose blades, and then you've pretty much got him.
I need to think about that. I could fight him on a number of things.
Yes, it has to be something serious.
Does it?
Yeah.
That Magic Roundabout film, which he loves and I think is rubbish.
I've heard about this, yes. I mean, if that is something that is affecting your friendship
Daily, yep.
seriously, daily.
Yeah.
And it needs to be laid to rest.
Okay.
I think then you have the basis for a meeting at dawn, which we can organise for you.
I'll mention it to him on Friday.
Hmm. I'd like to see that.
Well, as you said, you know, he can make it happen and in front of a large audience. But so the idea of a duel is quite entertaining, don't you think?
But isn't this the point which I meant to say, I am Inigo Montoya, you killed my father.
Prepare to die.
Prepare to die.
I don't think actually killing someone is involved in this. But the bit I'm not quite sure you're going to go along with is that clearly the idea is that if I win the duel, you have to accept that the issue is sorted.
Yeah, but if I win the duel, then...
Yes, well, equally the issue is sorted. But I can go along, you know, I can go along with that. But I can't imagine you just sort of changing your mind because you've been run through with a sword.
I think probably being run through with a sword is strangely persuasive in ways which one cannot even begin to imagine. But then I wouldn't choose a sword because now I know that you've got a bronze whatever it is in fencing. Mm. I'd choose, you know, how about a duel in which you hit... No, in which each person has a big one of those big containers of 3D glasses. You know, the ones that are being uselessly unrecycled over the country?
No,
what you do is you throw the 3D glasses at the other people. And the incredible thing about it is that will give you more of an effect of 3D than watching a film through the 3D glasses. Plus, it will put them to some use.
No, that's just a comedy duel. These are real duels with either pistols... Or swords.
Oh, I'll deal with you with pistols.
Yeah, okay. I'd rather a sword.
Because I've seen Love and Death. I know how that works.
You can choose the type of blade.
Okay.
But I think that would be a proper duel. What do you think? So James May says he wants us to duel.
Okay.
I mean, we could duel over whether you two are any good or not, but maybe it should be cinematic and we should do the ridiculous Magic Roundabout film.
Well, I love the Magic Roundabout film. It's coming out for the first time ever on DVD in a month or so. Thank you for setting that up for me. And amongst the special features, I believe, are interviews with Emma Thompson and me.
Great. Well, look forward to that.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK cinema top 10.
5 Live.
Clearly, Mark hasn't seen most of these because he's been away and can't be bothered. And so the gaps have been filled by you, the listener. Thank you very much. Marmaduke at number 10. Tim in Swansea. Utter bilge. At number 9, Avatar.
Very good and concise, that. Very good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Avatar Special Edition. Avatar Extended Edition.
Dear Simon and Funk Gargle, great to have you back. Avatar, extra footage, barely noticeable and adds nothing. My first 3D of the new era and Dr. K's right of novelty value only. Good. Alan in Stamford on that one. This from John Harvey. This week, my friend and I thought we'd try Avatar again, this time at the IMAX, and we were both completely surprised. Somehow a cut that's 8 minutes longer felt an hour shorter, and removed from all the hype at the beginning of the year, Avatar stands head and shoulders above most of this summer's blockbusters. There was a great buzz in the crowd, and while on the screen behind us people did talk, it was only to occasionally utter hushed thoughts like, "This is so cool."
Don't they look like Smurfs?
So that's Avatar at 9. Diary of a Wimpy Kid.
Oh, yeah, which actually the books of Diary of a Wimpy Kid are quite addictive.
Connor says, saw Diary of a Wimpy Kid a few weeks ago, along with Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which we'll come to. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, to me, was a disappointment. It wasn't terrible. I just expected more from the film. Acting is fairly enjoyable, but the jokes are rarely funny. Funniest performance was Devon Bostick, who played Big Brother Roderick. Other than that, no one else was that comedic. My recommendation would be only see it if there isn't much on.
Okay.
Okay, so Inception is at number 8 and number 7, and we've kind of done...
But can I take this opportunity to just say once again, on the question of Inception, two things that are interesting about it. One of them is that, as I have said before, it does prove that if you're going to spend that amount of money, you don't have to be stupid, because the fact of the matter is it's a huge amount of money to spend, but it made it back almost immediately. It's now going on to be one of the more successful films of the year, and it does demonstrate that if Christopher Nolan can apply the same intelligence he would apply to Memento, to a film like Batman Begins or Dark Knight, or to this, then there is no excuse for the Gore Verbinskis and the Michael Bays of this world to make those movies that they make as stupid as they make them, because the whole argument that actually stupid movies cannot be blockbusters and cannot make their money back is rubbish. Second thing is, one of the things that made Titanic a huge hit was repeat viewing. And of course, in the case of Inception, it is having a significant repeat viewing market from people going to see it a second time to see whether it, you know, matches up or makes sense second time, in the same way that a lot of people actually went to see The Sixth Sense twice, because once they'd got the twist, they wanted to watch the, you know, watch the film to see if it all added up as before. And a third point, and I mentioned this only in passing, do you know what the most expensive movie of all time was? Have a guess.
No idea.
Okay, when adjusted for inflation, Cleopatra. When unadjusted for inflation, and I'm not making this up, the most expensive movie ever made was Pirates of the Caribbean 3.
Something to look forward to for the next one, don't you think?
No, I mean, isn't, I mean, how bankrupt is a world in which that's true?
Lawrence Williams on this email, he's been to see Inception twice. He went to different cinema. He's posing a question that I suspect is rhetorical, and no one's going to answer it.
Okay.
He went to see it at different cinema chains so that to check the film stock.
Good for him.
Okay. He didn't want it to be the same.
Yeah.
And I confirmed my initial experience, says Lawrence, that the soundtrack for dialogue is definitely muffled. Is this intended to make understanding difficult and force repeat viewings, or just plain bad production? But I hadn't noticed that myself.
No, that's a mistake. I mean, I saw it projected and it wasn't muffled at all. So that's a projection mistake.
So Piranha 3D is at number 6. Ian, on this email, quick review for you here. In a recent video blog, the good doctor asked if a bad film is made better because the filmmakers know how bad it is.
Yes.
Judging by the evidence of Piranha 3D, the answer is a resounding no. Dreadful 3D, rubbishy effects, very few scares, very few laughs. Some films are so bad they're good, but this was just knowingly bad and no better for it. R Street says, on the plus side, it's a lot of fun and it certainly delivers the blood, gore and body parts. Once the piranha attack, there are heads, arms, entrails, legs and other bits and pieces all over the shop and floating in front of you. However, the 3D conversion just doesn't work. Well, it kind of works in places, but they're mainly the CG effects, which are in the computer and can thus be viewed from any angles. But you can't take a 2D image of, say, Elizabeth Shue and turn it into a three-dimensional object. All you can do is electronically move the 2D image in front of processed backgrounds to give the illusion of depth. Anyway, there's one.
My point entirely.
Indeed. Salt is at number
5. It's over to you, because you've seen this now, Simon.
Yes, well, okay. Well, on the plus side, it lasts about 90 minutes. It's an A to Z thriller.
It's an A to Z thriller. What does that mean? It's an A to Z thriller.
It starts at the beginning and works
its way. It's like a street map.
Works its way through to the end. But if you've seen 24, you will have watched it and thought, this just isn't good enough. And it just looks as though they found a Cold War script, dusted it off and thought, oh my word, this isn't going to work. I know, let's just change it a little bit. And I'm frankly fed up with seeing the President of the United States held hostage, because it's clearly the most easily penetrated building in the whole of the United States. And they just need to think of something better. Is that good enough?
Yeah, a friend of mine who saw it said that Angelina Jolie walks through the whole movie looking like somebody who hasn't yet been paid.
Is it Lev Schreiber?
Yes.
He's great. But yes. You know that whenever...
I think it's Lev.
Anyway, whenever he walks on...
Let's call the whole thing off.
Yeah. Whenever he walks on, you go, you're great, but you're up to no good.
Mm-hmm.
Brett on this, because we're at The Expendables at number 4. Utterly awful. Takes itself way too seriously, whilst being unintentionally hilarious at the same time. High point towards the end, after Sly and his team have blown everything up and fires are raging everywhere, Sly notices the girl he's trying to rescue. It cuts to a close on his eyes and we see the surrounding fire reflected in his eyes. That's the level of symbolism that we are circling here, although it is still better than the A-Team, he says. Expendables, the worst film I've ever seen, Mick in Edinburgh. On that one. So now, Toy Story 3, which is still at number 3.
I paid to go and see it again in 2D, because having had the conversation with Bob from Pixar, who is the Pixar 3D guy, who was, you know, sent me a very long and very, you know, intelligent missive about how they've really tried to underplay the 3D to just enhance the image and this, that and the other. And then I interviewed the director of Toy Story 3, who said, you know, I understand the whole foot candles issue, which is that you lose 4 foot candles when you put something through 3D glasses because it just dims everything down. And I got him almost to admit that he preferred it in 2D. But I said, I had to go and see it in 2D to compare. I have now seen it in 3D twice and in 2D once. And I'm here to tell you that the 2D version, which is the third time I saw it, was the best viewing experience.
But you did say when you saw it the first time that you forgot you were watching it.
I
watched it this week for the first time. Very interesting to go and see it when your son is indeed about to go to college.
Yeah.
In the next couple of weeks. But actually, the 3D is utterly pointless.
Yes.
Totally and utterly. And I walked out of that thinking there is no point. If that's all, I'd rather see it in a gimmick movie than for them to put. And I'm not looking forward to Harry Potter now.
No, I mean, of course, Harry Potter was shot in 2D. It wasn't. It's all been completely retrofitted into 3D. I mean, Toy Story 3D was designed in 3D, unlike Toy Story 1 and 2, which have been retrofitted into 3D. So, I am concerned about the fact that Harry Potter has been done in 3D because it was shot in 2D and it's meant to be a 2D film.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World is at number 2.
And this is, of all the things that's in the top 10 that I haven't seen, this is the one that I most regret having not seen, because there was a fantastic argument last week between Boyd and Floyd about whether or not it was any good or not. I have to say, it sounds like fun to me, but you can't judge until you've seen it. Never review a film you haven't seen.
Carol says, hello to Jason and Julian and, of course, the magnificent M&K. I viewed Scott Pilgrim last week on my day off. Completely full of a sinus infection, I sat at the back hoping not to be infectious and spread my germs to all and sundry. Having never read the graphic novels this movie is based upon, nor being much of a gamer, I couldn't help but giggle, chortle, guffaw and snicker at each wonderfully funny, silly and at times awkward emotional scene in the movie. From the off, with the computerized distributor logo and theme, the movie took off and took you on a roll through each of the battles with the seven evil X's, with great wit and excellent stunt work. Just what I would have wanted a movie to be comic. Just what I wanted a movie of comic-dom to be. Oh, it doesn't make sense, does it? And he got the girl.
Good.
So that's Carol on that one. So Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is new entry number 2. Grown Ups is the UK number 1. I've got it here.
Go on.
You ready for this?
Well, I have to say my expectations aren't high.
Why?
Just go, you know.
Patrick Mulcahy, if you have to pronounce it, from Stroud Green.
Mulcahy.
Thank you, Patrick. Mulcahy, then.
It must be Mulcahy. Is it Mulcahy?
That's the one.
Yeah, Mulcahy, like Russell Mulcahy, the guy who directed all the Duran Duran videos in Highlander.
Dear Messrs, Grown Ups, huh? Who says Americans don't get irony? First American film named after a British movie? All right, TV play by Mike Lee. The film is basically Adam Sandler filming his summer holiday. Or, to put it another way, making a film with a bunch of comedians that isn't as sour and, frankly, as funny as Funny People. Possibly one of the worst films of the year. I only saw it as I had one of those unlimited cards from a well-known cinema chain whilst son was watching Cats and Dogs 3D in an adjacent screening room. Why is it so bad? Well, firstly, because it puts you face-to-face with Sandler's ego. He's more successful than his fellow co-stars Chris Rock, David Spade, and so on. The latter pair to whom he gave a leg up to, producing Deuce Bigelow and Paul Blart, Mal Kopp. Boy, does he make you feel it. He's a Hollywood agent who shot the winning ball as a 12-year-old and whose only problem is his two annoying, luxury, good, addicted kids. The rest of his friends are failures and so on. Don't waste your time with this one, people, is how Patrick Mulcahy, indeed, concludes. Don't waste your time with this one. Is Adam Sandler referring to Funny People as a deliberate loss? Who cares, he says. Well, that sounds like you're going to enjoy catching up with that, Mark.
Excellent. I'll look forward to all the Expendables and that in particular. I'm looking forward to it. Scott Pilgrim is where I'm starting.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Mark is in Lerwick for the Shetland Isles Movie Festival there.
The Shetland Movie Festival.
I think you told me that last year.
Yes, and you forgot it almost immediately.
Well, 12 months on, you're quite right, I forgot it. So, take it away. What's movie number one? Looking forward to this particularly, having not judged it at all on the posters.
So, Dinner for Schmucks, which there have been buses going around with it on the side. For a long time, there was this rule on this programme that if something was advertised on the side of a bus, that therefore it wasn't going to be any good. And you said that word, and I said, no, that's not necessarily true. So, Dinner for Schmucks, which is a remake of a 1998-99 French film called Le Dîner de Cons, which I think meant dinner games. So the story is, Paul Rudd is this upcoming executive who needs a promotion. He needs a promotion. He needs to move up, needs to get into the next guy's office. He does something that makes the top boss guy kind of notice him. And the boss guy then says to him, okay, fine, in order to prove yourself, you have to come and take part in this ritual we have, which is the Dinner for Schmucks, in which what we do is we send everybody out to go and find somebody who's completely idiotic, and they then bring them to the dinner, and we then get together and laugh at them. So, you know, we are the successful people. We put on this thing that we think is a dinner for, that everyone else thinks is a dinner for winners, but in fact, it's you bring along an idiot and we laugh at them. Meanwhile, Paul Rudd is attempting to land a big contract with a Swiss banker played by none other than our very own David Walliams. Here's a clip.
Where are you from?
We are from Switzerland.
Barry, you know what? We're going to focus on business right
Switzerland.
Now.
I love Switzerland. It is one of my favorite countries. I love your army knives with the toothpicks and your cheese. Does the cheese come out of the cow with the holes?
Do you have been to Switzerland?
No, but I have a friend who drives a Volvo, and I speak a little of your language. Heard if he said there, turn up heard if he'd be.
So that's Steve Carell, who is the idiot who Paul Rudd runs down in the street and then realizes that maybe the passport to his promotion if he takes him along to the dinner for idiots. Meanwhile, there is a subplot going on, which is that Paul Rudd is going out with a woman who... There's a weird thing that's happened in Hollywood now, which is that if you want to give somebody's partner a non-specific job, you say they work in an art gallery. Everybody, every sort of non-specifically assigned attainable other now works in an art gallery. So Paul Rudd has this girlfriend who works in an art gallery and is dealing with an artist who's incredibly sexy and maybe somebody who dresses up as a goat in his spare time. And she doesn't want him to take part in the dinner for schmucks because it's a terrible thing to bring idiots along and laugh at them. And he doesn't want to break up with her, but on the other hand, he has to get the promotion, so maybe he's going to get Steve Carell to come along and be an idiot at the dinner for schmucks. Okay, fine. So that's the whole thing. Here's what you need to know about it. Very early on in the movie, during the opening credits, there's a credit for Sacha Baron Cohen. And then you see in the credits that David Walliams is involved in it. You know that Steve Carell is, you know, obviously somebody. There is like this cadre of very hip, very, very smart, very knowing comedians, all of whom have done, you know, interesting work. Many of them either British or Anglophiles. There's been a great kind of transatlantic, you know, handshaking. Oh, we love The Office on your side of the Atlantic. We love The Office on the other side of the Atlantic. Let's all get together. And what happens is this. In the movie, the idea is that these horrible rich people get together a bunch of misfits and laugh at them for being stupid enough to come along to the dinner for schmucks and not realize that they are schmucks, but actually they think they're at a dinner for winners. And I was sitting there watching the humorless vacuum that is Dinner for Schmucks and thinking, actually, the movie is basically like a kind of a metaphorical documentary of the way this happened. A bunch of these smug comedians got together and said, I know, let's make a movie in which we get all these people into a room who are idiots for coming to see this film, and then we laugh at them for coming along to see this film. I mean, it is just so staggeringly ill-judged and totally without humor. The weird thing is that in the French version, there's a kind of an underlying social thing going on, which is it's kind of a bitter social satire in that particularly sort of, you know, intelligent French way. And what you have here is just a comedy, an alleged comedy, in which there's a bunch of loathsome, unlikable, uninteresting, unbelievable, boring, carry-on type, stereotypical rich people who I don't care about, who rope in the collection of idiots, the lead one of which is Steve Carell, whose idiocy, incidentally, is that what he does is he takes dead mice and he stuffs them and he dresses them up as people and he makes them into little installations, like, you know, them in famous situations. He does a reproduction of The Last Supper when they're all mice, and he does the Mona Lisa, but it's a mouse, and he does Whistler's Mother, but it's a mouse. And you go, well, firstly, I've actually seen exhibitions in which people really do use mice, you know, in place of famous characters. You can buy greeting cards with mice instead of famous characters, and those people aren't idiots. Actually, they're making a huge amount of money. Secondly, the Paul Rudd character. Why on earth am I interested in what happens to the Paul Rudd character at all? Why is the woman that he's going out with interested in him when, in fact, she's running this incredibly successful gallery and clearly doesn't need to be wasting her time with this really awful, schmucky guy who halfway through the movie I'm meant to feel some kind of sympathy for because he's having some kind of moral crisis about whether or not it might be okay to take Steve Carell along to this dinner and humiliate him. But the overwhelming impression that I had is this bunch of people sitting around having this lovely slap-up meal in Hollywood, all, you know, smacking each other on the back and telling each other how great their last sardonic comedy was, and oh, I loved you in that, and I loved you in that. Did you see that French film? No, but I read the script. I loved you. I know. Let's get everyone together and let's get all this audience together in the room and let's just put them there and laugh at the fact that these schmucks are sitting in this room watching a comedy that we know is witless and dirgy and stupid and shouldn't have been remade from the French. And I mean it was all I could do to stop from going, okay, I've got it, I've got the joke, we're the schmucks, thank you, can we stop? It's without humour or redeeming feature in a way that was really quite shocking, and actually after a while became quite nasty. The tone of it was unpleasant, not in the way of unpleasant like a kind of rape, you know, you were mentioning before about sword fighting, not like a rapier, something, you know, stings you, oh, ow, ouch, you know, so you're smarting, but unpleasant in that way that if you get a piece of fruit and you leave it in the corner of a room and it starts to rot, and or it falls under the sofa and it starts to rot and disintegrate and starts to make a horrible smell, and you can't quite figure out where the horrible putrid, you know, putrefying smell is coming from, but you know there's just a bad odor in the atmosphere. It was like that. The atmosphere in the room in which I saw Dinner for Schmucks, I honestly, you could smell how bad the film was. It was really rotten, and I think we are the schmucks if we go see it.
Did you think all that because you are indeed a bit of a schmuck?
Well, that was the worst thing. I mean, you kind of feel, hang on, this is a double bluff, right? It's like you're kind of mocking me for being here watching this total piece of garbage, and I would walk out and leave, but I can't because it's my job, I have to say. But what I can say to you is, you know, if you pay to go and see it, then on your own head be it. I mean, I wanted to laugh. I sat down, the guy next to me, I said, oh, you're good, I'm looking forward to this, you know, Steve Carell and the original French film's quite funny, and, you know, I want to laugh. And I was insufficiently laughed. I think I laughed once by mistake.
Adam in Portadown just thought I'd point out that Le Dîner de Cons roughly translates as Dinner for Fools. I quite like the original film, and I have no interest in Dinner for Schmucks.
No.
Well, we're not going to fit anything else in, but let me just do this.
Sorry.
No, it was good. It was fun.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't good or fun.
No, but the last five...
It was neither of the above.
But the last 5 minutes were...
Oh, I see. Sorry, beg your pardon.
Hector on a text. Mark, for goodness sake, stop saying retrofitted.
No, it is retrofitted.
Stop, wait, let the text finish. Stop saying retrofitted. The term is dimensionalised. Okay? That's what it is.
Okay. Okay.
Simon Dennis on an email. Ooh, I missed this. Who's this? James.
What did he miss?
You.
Oh, I see.
Sounding off without breathing for 10 minutes.
But honestly, you should see Dinner for Schmucks. I mean, it really is. You can't. You
no,
just,
no, I really don't think I am.
I mean, I saw it and I came out afterwards, and Mark Lawson was in the screening. And I came out after, and I haven't seen Mark for a while. And we both just looked at each other and went, you know, like... It was like water torture.
Good. Put it on the poster. Print it. That'll be a DVD.
Dinner for Schmucks.
Seller.
That'll be you.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Wittertainment back here. And a number of texts and a number of emails. Simon, I love the ranting. We have missed Mark. Welcome back from Mel. Can't wait to see you in Newcastle. Hope Mark has a breathless rant like this one. You don't want to be too breathless in front of your public, do you? It could be embarrassing.
In front of my public?
Yes, in front of your public.
I believe they're our public, Simon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's in a couple of weeks' time. It's September 17th. It's a sellout. That's what it is.
Excellent.
Andrew in Cardiff, I saw Scott Pilgrim last week. I hated it so much. Me and my friend wanted to leave several times. However, we stayed to endure the pain. The story was rubbish. Michael Cera was wooden. I like most of the cast, apart from Sarah, of course, and 6 of the 7 evil exes. Jason Schwartzman was very good. I found the film overlong, overstylished, and just very dull. The gags were awful. This needs to stop. It was not original.
Well, I mean, I'm just excited because it's Edgar Wright, and I'm, you know, we've talked about Shaun of the Dead. I mean, I think Hot Fuzz is, you know, long and baggy, but I do think Shaun of the Dead really is great.
But then Mark in Birmingham, you see, says, "Dear Dr. Anne Hathaway and Honorary Dr. Kate Hudson." I imagine I'm going to be in a minority here after hearing Floyd and Boyd disagree over Scott Pilgrim last week on Wittertainment, the understudy edition. I was mildly concerned when taking my seat in the cinema this past Satsuma Wednesday. I like Edgar Wright. I like Michael Cera. I have an interest in most things geek and was therefore expecting to enjoy it. I did, however, really, really hate it.
Oh, really? So, okay. Okay. Oh, well, as I said, you know, I will pass judgment when I've seen it.
Something else new, please.
So the Switch, which is, you know, the latest in what appears to be a string of artificial insemination comedies. So the story is, okay.
How many? You say there's a string.
Well,
how many makes a string?
There's two others that I can think of.
Three makes a string, does it?
I would think so. Do you?
It's a sequence.
Sorry. I mean, it's such an odd subject that do you not think the clustering of more than one of these is remarkable?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
I mean, I'm sorry, but it's not just me. It's like that is an odd thing that suddenly these are turning up in the way they are. So the story is, Jennifer Televisual Aniston decides that she wants to have a child and she's going to do this by artificial inception, and she tells
artificial inception.
Artificial inception. That's right. It's an art. It's an AI. It's a film about artificial inception. Okay, and so she decides.
That's a whole other prospect for that next.
She decides that she's going to have to descend to the ninth level of her dream, where somebody will be playing "Non, je ne regrette rien" very, very slowly. And she says this to Jason Bateman, who's her best friend, but also sort of clearly has a big thing for her. And what she's actually done is that she's gone out and she has chosen the person who is going to do the donation, who turns out to be Patrick Wilson, because he fits all the bills, ticks all the boxes of the things that she wants from a child. We're going to play a clip. There was a couple of clips we had to have. They had to be editorially checked, so I'm not entirely sure which of the two we're going to play. So here's the
clip. It'll be the checked one, won't
it? No, it will be the checked one, but here it is.
So I would like you to be the first to know I'm having a baby.
You're pregnant?
Not yet, but I'm working on it. Went to the doctor. She said all my levels are really great. She said that my cervical mucus is gorgeous.
Thanks for that.
I don't need a man to have a baby.
Technically speaking, you do.
You know what? I'm going to do this. I want to have a kid, and I am in the market for some semen. And I need you to help me find some.
Right. Well, that's. I dread to hear what the other clip had then.
There we go. So the gag then is that due to a crazy drunken party mix-up, actually, Jason Bateman ends up being the person, unbeknownst to either of them, who actually is the person who is the technical father of the child, the biological father. This is the sound of somebody being unable to describe this plot. And so he actually is the father of the child, and the child is then born. Child then grows up strangely looking like Jason Bateman, and Jason Bateman realizes that in fact he has procreated without knowing. So
he's forgotten that he's had.
He hasn't, because it's all to do with artificial inception.
Oh, okay.
You see, it's everything.
So he never did.
So the whole comedy of this, and actually I think this is probably why this whole string of movies exists, is because it's a way of creating the kind of the procreation thing without the whole business of people actually being intimate with each other. And that's the central gag of any of these comedies. That is the central gag. You have created a child, but you haven't at any point actually been intimate with each other. Now, the thing with The Switch is, and I went in with incredibly low expectations because I've always found Jennifer Aniston very troublesome on the big screen. I don't know. I don't understand why she's just not just working on television the whole time. Jason Bateman I like very much. There's a very nice cameo sort of supporting role by Jeff Goldblum, who plays his concerned friend, his confidant. And Jeff Goldblum is great in almost anything. Jeff Goldblum is one of those people who has that strange weirdness that he had in David Cronenberg's The Fly. And whichever performance he does, I mean, recently I watched Jurassic Park again. I'd forgotten just how much fun Jeff Goldblum is in Jurassic Park when he does that fantastic speech about, you know, the whole problem is you stood on the shoulders of giants and you didn't do the science, you didn't do the work, and you spent so long asking whether you could do it. He didn't ever ask whether you should do it. And he's really good fun. And Jennifer Aniston is actually perfectly fine. And the movie isn't ghastly. And the movie isn't without some occasionally kind of cute and, you know, maybe passingly charmingly funny moments. I don't think it's great by any means. But in terms of the Jennifer Aniston material that we've seen, you know, in the past few years, it's certainly at the upper end of that. And I do think that Jason Bateman is an entertaining screen presence. And he does do that kind of downtrodden, schlubby character rather well. The problem with the whole thing is that because of the central mechanics of the plot, and you have you seen the trailer for this since then, Simon?
I believe I have.
Okay, well, you understand what happens, you know, that basically, you know, one specimen gets switched for another specimen, and that's how the whole thing happens. And the trailer explains this to you. But there's a terribly creaking plot moment working there to make the whole of the rest of the drama play out, so that the gag can then be that he has fathered a child without either him or the mother knowing that he's the father of the child, and he's then coming to realize that this may be the case or maybe it isn't the case, or maybe it did happen or maybe it didn't happen, and who in the gag is to do with his uncertainty. But it's such a clumsy, mechanical and clunking way of making that plot thing work that no matter how light or even-handed the rest of the comedy is, it never quite recovers from the fact that in the end, it's not a great idea. It sounds again like something that somebody pitched as, hey, how about this. And we went, oh, okay, fine. Well, we could possibly make that work if you pull that lever and you do that and you make that narrative. So I spent the whole thing thinking, it doesn't really work. It's kind of awkward. It kind of doesn't fit together. But occasionally there are moments in it which are more charming than I expected.
So what you're saying is, if you really want to see a comedy about artificial inception, then this is the one to choose.
If you really, it's the best Jennifer Aniston artificial inception comedy out this week.
Very good. Well, that's about as good as it's going to get for Jennifer.
No, but it's not terrible.
It's good for her.
It's not terrible. Okay. And she's certainly better in this than in many of the things I have seen her in before. Can they put that on the poster?
No. Nope.
She's better in this than many of the things that I have seen her on before.
What else do we look at?
Well, Last Exorcism is also out this week, which we haven't got a clip for, but I'll just describe this to you fairly easy. This is produced by Eli Roth, who, you know, blotted his copybook hideously by starting out making very interesting Cabin Fever and then, you know, downshifting into, you know, what is commonly referred to as torture porn with the Hostel movies. So the story with Last Exorcism is it's a mockumentary in which a guy who has performed a number of exorcisms, he's taking part in a documentary in which he says, look, I've done loads and loads of exorcisms, and I've realised over the years that the whole thing is bunkum, and it's all basically, it's ooga booga, and it's all, you know, it's all an act. And come with me now as I perform one last exorcism to show you how the whole thing is an act. He then gets called off to a very remote farmhouse where there is a teenage girl whose family believe that she is possessed by the devil. And he says, okay, I'm going to perform an exorcism, I'm going to show you how I'm going to do these tricks, and he hides little buzzers under the bed, and he has little speakers that make the demonic noises. But as he starts confronting the exorcism, he starts realizing that things are happening that are nothing to do with him, and he starts to wonder whether in fact the girl might actually be possessed. Now, the mockumentary format has clearly, you know, run its course. I mean, we've had, it's not just Blair Witch and Last Broadcast and most recently, you know, Paranormal Activity, but you know, there are so many mockumentary, Cloverfield even, it has been done pretty much to death. In its defense, Last Exorcism actually does it pretty well for a certain amount of the time. And there are moments in it in which, largely due to the central performance by the young girl who plays the possessed, it's a very physical performance and it's quite gripping. And there are moments in it that are creepy and there are moments in it that are a bit like, oh, and for a long time, I thought, actually, you know, they're doing something right here. They've got the idea. They've watched Requiem, for example, that German movie starring Sandra Hüller, which is fantastic, which is based on the real life case of Annalise Michel. And so I was surprised that for a good 40 or 50 minutes, it was doing pretty well, even though it actually didn't have faith in its own mockumentary structure, because it started doing reverse angles and there was non-diegetic sound coming in, and it didn't actually fulfill the remit of being something that looks entirely like a documentary. But for a good portion of it was creepy and entertaining and well thought out, and then it has the worst last 12 minutes of a film I've seen this year, partly because, having actually been pretty good for the first hour, the fact that it then chucks it out the window so badly in the last 10 minutes and just completely blows whatever goodwill or creepy interest it might have had. And of course, the thing is, if the very end of a movie is really rotten, what you remember when you come out of it is just how really rotten the end of the movie is. And I can't, have you ever seen that Ernest Borgnine film, The Devil's Reign?
Probably.
It's the one where Ernest Borgnine runs around with a pair of ram's horns on his head.
No, don't think so. Okay. Might have missed that one out.
That looked like a docudrama in comparison with what happens at the end. So it's a real shame, because there is interesting stuff going on in it, and it has some ideas, even though it doesn't have the strength of its convictions, and it has some genuine creepiness in it, and it has a couple of good performances, and it's done in a way that, you know, I mean, it's nothing like as good as Requiem, but it has a, you know, at least a purity of thought, and then it just goes, oh, we give up. And it just goes completely bonkers. And at the end of it, you just think, right, fine. I feel really cross, because I thought you were going to get away with that.
Tim Porter in Thamesmead. I saw this at Frightfest. I was not the only one who thought this movie was utter pants. Only Eli Roth could destroy a movie which was interesting, funny, well-acted and compelling, then turn it into one of the worst endings of all time.
Yeah, you see, there we go.
Eli Roth was the only person who attended Frightfest who needed 7 bodyguards around him in case things went bad. He really thinks he's the king of horror. Someone needs to tell him that. He's single-handedly destroying the genre with his garbage. Mark, you could go and lock him up and force him to make that costume drama that you mentioned.
Ashley Bell is the actress who we should know, because she is very, very good as the, you know, as the, is she or isn't she possessed? That's interesting that they're, you know, cited the ending. That's exactly what I think. And I think it's important, because no matter how no matter how well the rest of the movie may or may not play, the end is so rotten that when you come out of it, it's the end you remember. I mean, there are so many films, in fact, in which the film is terrible, but it has a feel-good ending. There was the whole principle of the guys, you know, who made all those movies in the 1980s, like Flashdance. I mean, it doesn't matter what the rest of the film's like. As long as everyone comes out remembering a good moment at the end, that's fine. Well, in the case of Last Exorcism, it's like that back to front.
More in a moment. We'll conclude. What's the next movie?
Let's do... should we do Cherry Tree Lane? Because I think you've got an email about it.
Who directed that?
Cherry Tree Lane is directed by Paul Andrew Williams, who has corresponded with the show.
An email from Paul Andrew Williams coming next.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's film review.
So this email from Paul Andrew Williams, the director of Cherry Tree Cottage.
Lane.
Cherry Tree Lane.
His previous film was The Cottage, if you remember.
You'll see the confusion here. So, after the dismal beating for The Cottage, another film hits the screens, says Paul Andrew Williams. No message for the audience, just an hour and 20 minutes of a tough event. Tell me, Sir Kermode, will I have a thumbs up or a thumbs hovering horizontally? Anything lower will result in me ringing Hollyoaks for a job. Take it away.
Well, the story of Cherry Tree Lane is it's a home invasion movie in which it starts off in which there are a couple who are kind of middle class couple. There is some unresolved broiling tension between the two of them. They're making their dinner. You see a thing of broccoli bubbling over, and this is where this is all going to go. They sit down, they have their dinner. There's actually a very nice opening sequence in which you're unsure exactly what the tension between them is. There's something to do with their son. They're having some sort of unspecified argument. Then there's a ring at the door. They open the door. People break into their house, and then it kind of what happens then is that they play out in real time. The people that have broken into their house say, "We come here to get your son," and horrible stuff happens. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it clearly owes a debt to Funny Games. Although I was listening to an interview with the director just yesterday, in which he was saying, and I think he said it elsewhere, that because he hasn't seen Michael Haneke's Funny Games. Now, have you seen Funny Games, Simon? I think you'd remember if you had. I mean, no, there's two versions of it. There's Haneke's version, the Austrian version, which is obviously German language, and there's the English language remake, which was completely redundant.
No, then.
And Funny Games is a really tough viewing experience. And what happens in Funny Games is that all the way through the film, the people who are committing this awful act of violence keep turning towards the audience, breaking the fourth wall, and saying, well, this is what you're here for, right? This is what you're here for. We're here for your entertainment. And it's like one of those films which keeps prodding the audience, saying, why are you here? Why would you watch this kind of film? What do you want to happen? What on earth are you doing then? One of the things I always had a problem with Funny Games was the fact that it was basically like being told off for the best part of 90 minutes. It was like, you know, a director who had decided to lecture you on the evils of horror movies. In the case of Cherry Tree Lane, it doesn't have any of that. In fact, and I was listening, as I said, to this interview with Paul Andrew Williams, he was saying, I don't have any thesis at all. All I'm trying to do is to create something that creates a reaction and makes the audience feel, you know, uncomfortable and scared. And there isn't. It's not a discussion about violence or a discussion about the aesthetics of violence. It's not that at all. And whilst I was watching it, I found myself thinking, well, actually, it needs to be about that, because the problem with Cherry Tree Lane is that he has technical abilities. I mean, if you look at London to Brighton, which was a very, very audacious first film, then there was The Disappointment of The Cottage, which just didn't work for me at all. I didn't think the humour worked, or I think that horror comedies are very, very hard to get. What you have with Cherry Tree Lane is something which has a technical proficiency. There is, you know, shots which are organised in a way which is technically proficient and which is, you know, just shows a directorial eye. And it is undoubtedly the case that what happens mechanically in the film works in a way which is at its best sort of efficient, but there isn't anything behind it. And the problem with it is that actually I never thought I'd be in this position. I sat there watching it thinking, why isn't this Funny Games? And as I said, Paul Andrew Williams said, I haven't seen Funny Games. And I came out of it thinking, you know, you probably should have done. Because although I think there's a problem with watching a film in which the director is telling you off, at least he was telling me something. My problem with Cherry Tree Lane was I felt there wasn't anything in it. It was what it was. It was a film about people breaking into somebody's home and the ensuing unpleasantness, and then it stopped. And because it's so close in its setup, to Funny Games. I can't get the ghost of Funny Games out of my head. And Funny Games is a film that literally messes with your mind and argues with you and shouts with you and wrestles with you and you know, causes me to be very annoyed, actually. But at least I was engaged. My problem with Cherry Tree Lane was I just wasn't engaged by it. For all its efficiency, it needed to have something to say. That's the problem. And in fact, in that email that you just read, the director said exactly that, didn't he? He said he wasn't, you know, not a message film, just what it was. And I think, you know, I still have every confidence that he is very talented and will do, you know, very good work in the future. This isn't it.
He emails again. Hello, Paul Andrew Williams. His final rather pleading email. You've got to like it more than Dinner for Schmucks.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, and I don't mean this badly, but, you know, it's slamming your finger in the car door is better than Dinner for Schmucks. I mean, you know, Dinner for Schmucks is really, really poor. And as I said, I don't think it's a badly made film. I just think it doesn't have an argument, and I wanted it to have an argument.
I was confusing it with Funny Girl, I think. That was why I was
Funny Girl,
slightly...
yes. Michael Haneke's Funny Girl is a film I would definitely pay to see. Got time for a couple of others?
I think so. Do you think Jason Isaacs is still listening? He's probably listening live, do you think, as he's wandering around?
No, he's not. He's taken the kids off to the swimming pool.
Yeah, but you know that he's listening underwater.
No, he'll be listening on the podcast, but which can't happen until after we finish the programme.
Hello, Jason, anyway. And Michael Sheen and David Morrissey, Stephen Fry... Do we agree to say hello to Eddie Marsden on a weekly basis?
Oh, yes. Hello to Eddie Marsden.
And Cillian Murphy.
Yes.
Our new friend. And Danny Boyle. Anyone else?
No. Can I very quickly run through a couple of other films? Because I'm aware I'm going to run out of time.
There you go. Bringing it back to films all the time.
Okay, so very quickly. Jonah Hex, which is an adaptation of a comic book, and it's boring. I mean, it's 81 minutes long, and it's basically the story of this guy. He may be alive, he may be dead, nobody's quite sure. His face is hideously scarred through some backstory, which is set up at the beginning of the movie rather badly. John Malkovich runs around chewing the scenery, doing that I'm working in an old Western, slightly gothic, slightly comic book inflected thing, but you know what, I don't really care. All I care about is at some point I'm going to get paid for it. The story has apparently some political undertones in that what happens is that although it's an old sort of, you know, Civil War style retro film, and in fact it ends up being a terrorist attack on Washington and blah-de blah-de blah-de, and it's Neville Dean and Taylor who are the people who did the Crank movies, and Crank 2 was you know, utterly without without virtue. It's directed by Jimmy Haywood, I think, and it's, you know, it is just kind of all over the place. And then Certified Copy, which is the Abbas Kiarostami movie, which is the film for which Juliette Binoche won the Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival. And the story is, at the beginning of the film, Juliette Binoche is running an office, and an English guy comes in, and he's an author who is visiting, who has written a book about how copies can be every bit as valid as originals. They agree to go out together to have a nice day out and to share a cup of coffee and maybe have a meal together. And they go out, and whilst they're out, somebody mistakes them for a married couple. And they then start pretending to be a married couple. Or are they pretending, or are they? Do they actually have some kind of history? And they're play acting as this old married couple who are then talking with an honesty and candor that they didn't have before the play acting started. Maybe before they were play acting. Maybe what we're seeing now is role-playing. Maybe actually one of the characters is entirely in the mind of the others.
What's the answer?
Well, the answer is you don't know. And I have to say that, for a large portion of the audience, when I first saw it in Cannes, the answer was also that they didn't care. Now, I've now seen the film twice, because having seen it in the cinema, I was kind of very troubled by, in the Cannes Film Festival, I was very troubled by whether or not it was, it was anything more than just a festival film. Having seen it again, actually, here's what I think. I think that Juliette Binoche's performance is really, really terrific. I think that she is the standout thing in the movie, and that's one of the reasons why it remains quite so magnetic. I mean, it's kind of like after sunrise, but what's it called?
Just before dawn.
It's before sunrise, isn't it? Before sunrise and before sunset. Well, it's like that, but kind of, you know, with A-levels and to some extent kind of international ambitions. It is about play acting and about how much characters really are, what they pretend to be. And to some extent, it's about the nature and the artifice of drama. And there are things in it that are actually quite charming. And the second time round, I found much more engaging. The first time round, I thought, these people are doing very, very good performances. But you know what? Actually, what they're doing is, it's kind of, you know, it's arty and it's self-referential and it's navel-gazing and it's not that engaging. Second time round, I was far more engaged. I mean, I do think Kiarostami is a really interesting director. It is, to some extent, a festival film. But second time round, I found it to be far less irksome than the first time round. And actually, looking at it against the rest of the week's releases, I think it may well be the film of the week.
You can't really do that.
Why?
Because you've just said, so imagine there's a conversation type. People go on to go and see it. What should we go and see? Like, how about Certified Copy with Juliette Binoche? What's it about? Well, Mark says it's about the nature and artifice of drama. Oh, right, okay. And we have to go and see it twice. And the second time, it's slightly less irksome. Well, now that, as a recommendation for a movie of the week, is not very strong.
Yeah, but you can say, we can either do that, you can go and see a movie which second time around is slightly less irksome, or you can go and see a film written by, you know, Neville Dean and Taylor, and which is really annoying all the way through, or you can see a horror movie which lets you down really, really badly in the last 10 minutes, or you can see Dinner for Schmucks, which is really, really grisly, or you can see the best Jennifer Aniston artificial inception comedy of the week. I mean, give me the Kiarostami.
Or the extra 8 minutes in Avatar for the singing
ring. No, you don't
want
that.
Or Toy Story 3. Well, I want to see that more than I want to see a film about the nature and artifice of drama, which is slightly less irksome when you've seen it.
But it's got Juliette Binoche in it, and she's really good.
Well, I'll go and see her in something else then. Or just look at
her. Oh, okay, fine. Go and see her in something else in which she might not be good.
Have a great week. See you next Friday. And that's the end of this week's podcast. Personally, I think I'm glad that we're back.
I thought it was new and improved.
Was it as well? Are we better than we used to be, or have we got a little bit worse? Do you think?
I don't know. Shall I listen back to it?
No, you don't want to listen to it again, do you? But do you think as though we're still improving?
I think that every time I'm with you, I'm improving. Every day, in every way, we're getting better and better.
We got Joe Dante on the programme next week.
Have we?
Yes, the Gremlins fantastic. Director, Chappie.
I think you'll find he's got a new film since then, Simon. That was 25 years ago.
Well, it was the last thing I bothered to look at that he'd done. Anyway, so much to look forward to on next week's podcast. For the moment, goodbye.
Adieu.
To you and you.
And you.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kurt Mode and Mayo's Film Review.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.